Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 2.5 years ago, the space shuttle Columbia exploded, killing all 7 crew members. It was a stark reminder of the dangers of space exploration. Today, NASA Administrator Michael Griffin was on Capitol Hill. He told the House Science Committee that the space shuttle Discovery should be ready to blast off again in July.
I've participated in every technical review that was appropriate for me to do. Since coming on board as administrator, and I believe I have acquired a pretty good picture of where we are with respect to the technical requirements to return to flight. And I think, based on what I know now, we're ready to go.
Griffin's remarks come one day after the space agency's own advisory committee raised caution flags about the shuttle's safety, and a week after a former NASA insider said that the Bush administration's plans for human space exploration are doomed to failure without more money and some fundamental changes in space policy. The path to man's final frontier doesn't seem as clear as it did back in 1969. Tonight on Point, the future of NASA. Is it lost in space? We begin in Washington, where today NASA Administrator Michael Griffin was on Capitol Hill, as you just heard. Tracy Watson is the NASA correspondent for USA Today and joins me now from Washington. Welcome to the program, Tracy.
Thanks for having me, Gail.
So was this a coincidence, Griffin's appearance today, or was it in response to some of these concerns by the oversight panel?
This hearing had been scheduled for a long time, but it did provide a happy coincidence, a chance for Americans to hear how Mr. Griffin would respond to the recommendations of the safety panel.
And why is the timing important now for the shuttle either to fly again or not?
Well, the International Space Station has gone for 2.5 years now without a service call from the shuttle, and it gets most of its water, its oxygen, its food, and other supplies via the shuttle. Things up there are breaking down, supplies are running low, so it's important for the space station's safe operation to have the shuttle flying again.
And so while America's shuttles have been grounded, what's been happening? Have the Russians been going back and forth?
That's right. Russian cargo craft have been flying back and forth, and as have Russian passenger craft carrying a few astronauts up every 6 months or so and then bringing them back. But the Russian supply craft are not really big enough to deliver the amounts of supplies that the space station needs, nor are they big enough to continue construction of the space station, which is only about half done.
Well, today in his testimony, Griffin seemed to put it in some pretty stark terms, either go now or just say, we're not going to go again.
Yeah, I think that they're really ready, really looking now at a July launch. They seem to be pretty serious about it. They do have one final review coming up tomorrow and Thursday, at which they'll look very, very thoroughly at all the different potential problems, all the different concerns they may have that could block launching in July. But barring some kind of unforeseen circumstance that comes up in that review this week, it looks pretty likely that they are going to fly.
And what were specifically those 3 safety concerns that the oversight panel was pointing out? And was that something of an embarrassment for them to make that public?
I don't think it was a big surprise to NASA that those 3 safety concerns were judged to be not fulfilled. They are 3 of the most important of the safety recommendations that NASA vowed to make after the Space Shuttle Columbia accident in 2003, so I would imagine they're not thrilled about this. And the 3 are an ability to repair the shuttle in orbit, the prevention of debris from coming off the shuttle's fuel tank, and a toughening of the orbit of the shuttle's external skin to make sure that if debris does hit it, it is not severely damaged. The panel said that they had made that NASA has made progress on all 3 of those efforts, but hadn't quite gotten all the way to fulfilling the letter of the recommendations.
As you go around on Capitol Hill these days, do you get the sense that Congress is still committed to the space program?
Very much so. Both the House and the Senate have decided, the House and Senate committees have decided to give NASA a pretty big chunk of money for fiscal year 06, which starts in September. And both senators and members of the House have said in the past couple days that they're willing to abide by whatever NASA says in terms of whether the shuttle is ready to launch again or not. So I don't sense a diminishment of support for NASA among legislators.
And you also wrote about an intriguing little piece of this about a complication with the Iran Non-Proliferation Act. What does that have to do with the space program?
Seemingly nothing, but it's turning out to be one of NASA's biggest headaches. That legislation prevents the U.S. from paying money to Russia and Russian companies under certain circumstances, and unfortunately those circumstances prevail right now. And that means that NASA cannot pay Russia to launch astronauts on Russian spacecraft after April 2006. Dr. Griffin, the head of NASA, did say today that he was going to ask Congress to change that act, because if we can't send astronauts to the space station past 2006, it's going to be very, very difficult for U.S. astronauts to spend any time up there at whatsoever.
Tracy, thanks so much for the update.
Thank you.
Tracy Watson is NASA correspondent for USA Today. She spoke with me from Washington. We invite you to join the conversation this hour. Do you have confidence in NASA and its vision? What answers do you think space holds for us now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Arlington, Vermont, is Andy Chaikin, science journalist, space historian, and author of Man on the Moon. His forthcoming book is about the passion for Mars exploration. Andy, welcome to you.
Hi, Gail. Nice to be with you.
And also joining us from Pasadena, California, is Bruce Murray, Professor Emeritus of Geology and Planetary Sciences at Caltech. He was director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory from 1979 to 1982, and a key figure in all of the early Mars missions, including Mariner 9, which mapped the planet for the first time in 1972. Bruce Murray, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Bruce, let me start with you. I'm interested in your reaction to that advisory panel report about some safety concerns on the eve of what may be a new launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery.
Well, if I might take the initiative here in answering it, I think that's jumping ahead of what the right question should be, because the question is, why humans in space? And a quick answer that will come out when you look at that is it's space is intrinsically risky for robots and for humans. That means there are going to be casualties, there will be deaths in space, and so the figure of merit that has to be used in authorizing any flight of humans into space is it worth dying for? Are they going to do something really important? And I think that's where we've lost our vision a bit, even after Challenger and other problems that have happened, Columbia. We didn't really go back to that key issue.
Well, we're going to be exploring that in some detail over the next hour. But, Andy, let me ask you just to give me a narrow focus on that single point at this point. Your reaction to the panel's report?
Well, I'm like everybody else. I don't like to hear about anything going wrong that could endanger the lives of the crew. But at the same time, I understand that you can't eliminate all the risks or you'd never fly at all. So the only thing I can do is hope and trust that the people who make the decisions on whether to fly are making them based on weighing the information in the right way. I do, not to keep frustrating your efforts to comment on the panel, but I do want to address the question that Bruce just raised. And I take my lead in many ways from what Bruce Murray has said over the years. He's been not only a superb scientific participant in the space program, but a great commentator on it. I feel that the time is right for us to be taking the risks in order to explore space. And where we've gone wrong in the past, including with the shuttle, is we got away from exploration as the central motivation. Many of the decisions that were made that put the shuttle up there and then the space station were more along the lines of what Deke Slayton, the astronaut, used to call an aerospace WPA, just to keep the jobs flowing and the NASA budget as large as it had been during Apollo. And of course, they couldn't do that because the budget kept diminishing. But I think that the hopeful thing here is that we are finally talking, at least, about a program that is focused on scientific exploration and discovery. Now, can that be done without breaking the bank? That's the goal. That's the paradigm.
Well, do you agree with Bruce Murray that what the first President Bush used to refer to as the vision thing has been a problem for NASA?
I think there have been a lot of problems for NASA, one of which is that NASA has to take its orders from the top. It can't really set its own agenda without a presidential mandate. So that was step number one. Step number two is, I think NASA, you know, to quote the old line from Cool Hand Luke, has a bit of a failure to communicate with the public. And if anything is going to happen in space, the public needs to be involved. The public needs to be reflected in what NASA does. Its support is crucial. And the fact is, and this is something that is documented by polling that was done before and after the Bush the Younger made his space speech in January of 2004, the public has a very high degree of support for space exploration. At the same time, they express frustration that they don't know enough about what NASA is doing. And I think that aside from the tremendous technical challenges of sending humans beyond Earth orbit for the first time in a generation since Apollo, the public relations aspects are something that I don't think NASA's paying nearly enough attention to.
Well, we're going to pick up on that point when we return in just a moment. We're talking this hour about NASA's future and the future of space exploration and public enthusiasm for it. What's your reaction when you hear about a space shuttle launch? Excitement? Dread? Boredom? Is it human destiny to explore space, or is the romance over? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, and that's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about a vision for America's space program. In January of 2004, President Bush announced his bold vision for space exploration from the moon to Mars and beyond.
Today, we set a new course for America's space program. We will give NASA a new focus and vision for future exploration. We will build new ships to carry man forward into the universe, to gain a new foothold on the moon, and to prepare for new journeys to the worlds beyond our own.
That was President Bush speaking at NASA headquarters January 14th of 2004. And so we ask, does NASA need to rally the country behind one clear mission like going to Mars? Is space a frontier to be explored, or is it a place for scientific experimentation? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking tonight with Andy Chaikin, space historian and author of Man on the Moon, and with Bruce Murray, professor emeritus of geology and planetary sciences at Caltech. He was director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory from 1979 to 1982. And Bruce Murray, I wonder if you'd help us remember, for anyone who was around in the 60s, you know, we have vivid memories of man landing on the moon, but for those born since then, they may well have a different impression of NASA. They may think more about the space shuttle disasters, for example. And I wonder if that makes a difference in terms of public support for the agency. You know, is the thrill gone? And so then how do you make the case to a new generation that the space program is still worth it?
Well, I think the key to that is doing things that are produce results that people acknowledge are important. And in case of manned flight, they have to be important enough to risk the loss of life. And I'm afraid that that's where NASA and the country have failed. I don't think the country as a whole has embraced the fact that space is really risky and that some people will die. They look upon them as accidents rather than as things that are almost inevitable. And they look upon the entity that led this to happen as somehow having failed rather than having run into a realistic probability. So I think we, American people, all of us, are at least as a part of the problem. The other has been that our leadership, at the political sense and otherwise, has not been willing to be upfront about this. And that's the only reason we should be doing space exploration with humans. And if we don't feel it's worth it, or we're not going to the right places that justify those risks, then we shouldn't do it.
Andy, what about that? Is this a case of three strikes and you're out? You know, we've had the Challenger and the Columbia disasters. Will the public just not accept another accident in spite of the fact that, as Bruce Murray points out, there are inherent dangers and risks in space exploration?
Well, my sense is that the public is willing to accept the risks if they're done for something that, as Bruce says, is worth it. I don't know that people feel that the shuttle and station has been worth it. I do get the sense, again, from the polling data that I've seen, because I think that's the only way that somebody in my position, I'm just one person, the polling data seems to indicate that people really are excited about the idea of exploring the solar system, not only with humans, but with robotic missions like the two rovers that are on Mars right now, and which are the legacy of the missions that Bruce took part in back in the 60s and 70s. And I think that people are extremely excited about answering fundamental questions, how the Earth and the planets came to be, whether there might be life on worlds beyond Earth. And I think also that there is a spiritual uplift. And I think we're desperately in need of that greater awareness that space exploration gives us. And I refer, you know, as sort of the touchstone moment during Apollo was looking back at the Earth, and, you know, as the astronauts told me when I wrote my book, they could see with their own eyes that Copernicus was right, that the Earth is not the center of the universe and that we'd better take care of it. Hmm. Well, that kind of planetary consciousness is something that goes against much of our culture today, but I think space is one of the things that can help us get that back.
Well, let me ask you about your short list of the tangible benefits, the things that we can really, you know, put on a short list from the trillions of dollars that have been spent so far in space.
Well, one of them is the tremendous boost that it gives to interest in science and math and engineering among our young people. You know, we're facing a shortage of qualified technical people and engineers and PhDs, and this is not just a current phenomenon. This has been developing for a long time. And, you know, space is one of the things that's a magnet for young people. I think NASA should have, after that speech by the president, should have gone into every classroom and sent a poster to every teacher saying, you have a chance to be part of the first human missions back to the moon and to Mars. The people who are, you know, the kids who are in kindergarten today, 5 years old, will be just the right age to take part in that. So that, I think, is a very tangible benefit. There are technological advances that happen because space exploration means trying to do hard things. That's just what Jack Kennedy said when he spoke about Apollo. We do these things not because they're easy, but because they're hard. It's good for societies to do hard things. The scientific benefits that we're getting out of it are extraordinary. We know much, much more about the Earth and the way the Earth works and about weather on the Earth and the Earth's climate and the care and feeding of our own planet by virtue of studying other planets. I'm sure Bruce can, you know, make a much more compelling case than I can, but you know, that's just touching scratching the surface there.
Well, Bruce, I would imagine you would have many of the same things on your list. What else would be on your list of benefits?
Well, I think the most important, and it's so much more important than almost everything else, is the sense of adventure, and it leads to enhanced self-esteem by taking humans. Almost everything else we can do more cheaply and with less risk robotically. But one thing that humans do is they put us there. We, all of us, are on the moon or in the spaceship going out. That's important provided we're going somewhere. And it gives the whole country, to some extent the world, a sense of destiny, a sense of destination. That's sorely lacking at present time. And it, unfortunately, nothing short of that is going to justify the risk. So we have to either face up to doing that or recognize that the program, the human flight program, is going to be chasing mediocre goals and the next set of accidents will probably terminate it.
To our phone lines now. First to Cary, North Carolina. Darren is joining us from Cary. Hello, Darren. Welcome.
Hello, thank you. Yes, there was a question earlier about how do you feel about the space shuttle launches when you hear them. And honestly, they are rather humdrum. What I really find exciting, what a lot of people I know find exciting, are the deep space probes, the Mars orbiters, the Russian solar sail deployment that may have failed, but to see our exploration efforts, and things like the Mars rovers, where anybody could open up a web browser and go and look at the results live as they were happening, that we can get involved in. My impression as a child with the space program, with the astronauts, was that here are the six people that finally got to go on a space shuttle, that almost no one can be directly involved in it. I'd like to see more involvement in the deep space probes, more missions. I mean, look how much data we're still getting out of things that we've launched when I was a child.
Darren, thanks for the call, and I want to pursue particularly that point with Bruce Murray about the Cosmos One, the world's first solar sail spacecraft mission. You were involved in that, Bruce, founder of the Planetary Society, which is the largest space public interest group in the world. But that, what, crashed soon after takeoff, or there was some question about whether it was still floating around out there somewhere?
Well, just to calibrate it, it was launched on a Russian rocket, a good one. It's actually a submarine rocket, and it replaced the warhead with this very benign payload, which was intended to go into orbit and then deploy a large, lightweight sail-like device that would pick up the solar energy and be propelled by it and prove out that concept. The Planetary Society is a private, non-governmental group that raised the money and provided the direction for that, and it was actually the Russian Space Agency that did the technical work. That loss, I mean, a lot of people say, how do you feel? I've been in space a long time, and so I've seen a lot of failures, and one gets kind of accustomed to the fact it's a risky business. It's risky for the robots, it's risky for the humans, and it's going to be that way. So you have to be able to kind of shrug your shoulders and move on when that happens. That's certainly the way I feel now.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation now from Houston, Texas. George Abbey is Senior Fellow in Space Policy at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. And from 1995 to 2001, he was director of the Johnson Space Center. He's co-author of a study that was released just last week by the National Academy of Arts and Sciences titled United States Space Policy, Challenges and Opportunities. And it's been getting a lot of attention. George Abbey, welcome to you.
Well, it's good to be here.
You make a case in your paper as to how the U.S. could hold on to its traditional leadership position in space. I wonder if you could briefly make that case for us now.
Well, I think that certainly we have demonstrated a capability to lead the way in space. But I think the concern both that Neil and I have is that we're losing out on that for a number of reasons. And I think you probably have talked about some of those in the course of the discussion this evening. But I think that is really of concern to us. There's what we consider to be at least four barriers that would preclude us retaining that leadership role. The international trade on arms regulations that I think have made it very difficult for us to work with international partners and for other countries to buy goods and services from us, space goods and services from us. And that's a real concern. And I think it's carried over and made it more difficult for students from other countries to come study in the United States to get visas. And that's a real problem. And I think with the shortage of scientists and engineers in our country, enabling scientists and engineers to come from other countries to work here in our country is important because we do have a shortfall in science and engineering. And that's the second barrier that we're concerned about, because I think unless we do something to increase the number of young people going into science and engineering, it's going to be a problem not only for our space program, but for all our technology activities, because we don't manufacture a lot of goods in the United States at this time, but we do have a leadership role relative to technology right now. But I think if we're going to maintain that lead, we've got to have young people continue to go into those fields. And with the situation now where the enrollment for engineers and scientists is going down around the country at our universities, that's a real concern. And I think as you look at the space program, the civil space program, and the president's vision that he outlined of going back to the moon and Mars, I think that's a very challenging vision, and I think it's a very one that we ought to pursue, certainly going to the moon and Mars, and But I think you've got to have a balanced program. We've had, I think, as probably you discussed already, significant achievements in robotic activities. And I don't think we can neglect our science and our Earth observation and our other activities that I think are important, as well as aeronautics as far as NASA's concerned. So I think we need to have a balanced program, not necessarily the program that we're on course for now. And I think the other important thing is international cooperation. I think we've proven the benefits of that. I think the International Space Station is flying tonight with a cosmonaut and an astronaut on it because we've been able to get support from the Russians while the space shuttle hasn't been flying. So I think international cooperation has got to play an important role in whatever we do in the future, certainly looking to going back to the moon and going to Mars.
I want to go to our phone lines again to Atkinson, New Hampshire. Donald is on the line. Hello, Donald.
Yes. I'd like to give my greetings to Andrew from the Boston chapter of the National Space Society. And I'd like to talk about the shuttle, and particularly the fact that they've flown it way too long, and I'm literally sitting here looking on my web browser to an authorization bill where, you know, a senator from Texas is trying to mandate that it fly even longer than it should be. And
they're talking about now it's stopping at 2010, right?
Right. And, you know, it shouldn't even be flying that long. It was an experiment. It was good for its time, but, you know, it's way too complex, and they're running to the other side of the bathtub curb when it comes to failures, and, you know, they're starting to see them. You know, this is normal in the aircraft industry. The people who are in charge know about it, and you've been hearing them, saying it's not ready to fly and everything because they're just really nervous. They know what's going on with the engineering and the failure modes. And NASA should be procuring its transportation like the government, you know, rents trucks or leases buildings. You know, when it needs something, it goes to private industry and they provide it. I mean,
well, Donald, let's put that question to Andy Chaikin. Could the private enterprise do it better?
Well, that everybody would love to see that happen, but you know, the bottom line is space is hard. Getting out of that gravity well into Earth orbit, just the first 200 miles, is a tremendously difficult problem. And I'd actually like to throw a question over to George Abbey, because, you know, George, you were right there on the front lines. I know you were frustrated when you were running the Space Center in Houston that there were no options to get out of low Earth orbit. If you had one thing to say to the people that are going to try and make this happen, how do you start from the point we're at now and create the vehicles to get humans beyond Earth orbit without it being breaking the bank and without it being, you know, too risky, and solving all those technical problems in the real world environment of contractors and inflated budgets and all of that?
And George, if you can do that in about 2 minutes, I'd be grateful.
Well, I think that's going to be a real challenge. I think Mike Griffin has got a good understanding of that, and I think he's trying to move NASA in that direction. But I think for the reasons that Neil and I have outlined relative to those four barriers, I think that's going to be hard, because I think as you look at going back to the Moon and Mars and look at when we did it before versus now, we certainly had a great depth in the industry. We had a great number of people, young people going into science and engineering. And I think that capability is probably not there today. So I think it's going to be a real challenge. I think Mike understands that, and I think he's going to try and do what he can to reinvigorate NASA. And I think, we've got to go in that direction. I think we've got to get that capability and look at doing it internationally, bringing our international partners in and making them a part of it. And I think we have to look at coming up with realistic international trade in arms regulations that make it compatible for us to work with our partners.
Well, I would ask for a really short answer on this one, but George, it's fair to say, I guess, that we can get more science done with robotics, or at least get a great deal of science done with robotics, but does it take human travel to get the public excited about space again?
Well, I think it's certainly the robotic activities are very exciting, but I think you need a combination of both. I think that if we're going to the moon, I think you can learn a lot robotically, but you also need the human presence as well. And I think if you look at Hubble, for example, Hubble is an excellent example of how we have combined our robotic activities with our human activities, and Hubble has been a great facility for science and astronomy. But it is capable of doing what it's doing today, and if we resurface it, we'll be capable of doing even more if we can combine and bring up humans to do that.
All right, gentlemen, stay with us. We have to take a brief break here. We're talking about the future of NASA this hour and about America's appetite for space exploration. Would the money be better spent on planet Earth? Should we send humans in space or just robots? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking tonight about NASA's future and about the value of space exploration today. Is it human destiny to explore space? Or is the romance over? What do you think is out there? And how much do you care? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Andy Chaikin, science journalist, with Bruce Murray, former director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and George Abbey, a senior fellow in space policy at Rice University. To Somerville, Massachusetts now, we want to hear from Ben. Hello, Ben.
Good evening.
What would you like to contribute or ask?
Well, I think that, I should say I've been interested in space since I was a small child. I studied astronomy and dreamed about going to the moon and Mars and places like that. And I think the best thing we can do for space is to make sure we have our motives straight. Otherwise, we're going to spend an awful lot of money for very small returns. The early American space program was really politically driven, as was President Bush's remarks about Mars. And many of the later shuttle flights were criticized for having questionable scientific value. If our purpose in going to Mars is scientific exploration, then robots really are the way to go. Transporting living human beings all the way to Mars and then giving them back alive is hideously expensive for a very small advantage. If the point is to actually set a living human foot on Mars, I mean, that's a wonderful idea, but we have to think how much we're willing to spend for that. If they offered me the chance to go to Mars tomorrow, I would go in a shot. I would spend those 4 years in space each way, or how much it is, and I would endure a significant risk of fiery death to do it. But I'm not sure I would ask somebody to contribute $100 billion to that effort without being able to provide something better than just a thrill.
Gail, can I take a crack at that?
Certainly.
The spirit of what you're saying is absolutely right on, that we have to be sure of our motive and clear about our motive, and that the motive that I think and most people think ought to be is scientific exploration. Having said that, nobody is talking about going to Mars tomorrow. The key here is to develop infrastructure. It is to develop a set of machines that can routinely take people beyond Earth orbit and do it without breaking the bank and doing it with a minimum risk, whatever that level of risk turns out to be. We're just at the beginning of trying to create those machines and those techniques. We tried to create a reusable spaceship with the shuttle to lower the cost of just climbing out of the gravity well into low Earth orbit, and we failed to lower that cost. The shuttle's a wonderful experimental vehicle, but we've got to do things a different way. They're not talking about going back to the moon until 2020, and not back to Mars, not sending anybody to Mars until, perhaps 10, 15 years after that. So I think the most important thing that's happening right now is that we are talking about a space program that is dedicated to scientific exploration, and I'm just hoping and praying that we do make our decisions with that in mind, and that does involve robots until you need humans. In other words, you send the robots to do as much as you possibly can, just as those rovers are doing up on Mars right now. But at some point, you will need to send humans to make the new discoveries that we want to make.
Well, Bruce Murray, let me just put that question to you in a very basic way. What is the point of going to Mars? Is it
right? I'm awfully glad you asked, because I've been chomping trying to get a word in edgewise. I think it's very clear. The only reason to send humans to Mars or away from the Earth at all is to determine if that location, that in this case Mars, is a potential habitat for humanity. That is, in a long run of history, an important question. we could be threatened by asteroid impacts or things like that. It's not an immediate crisis. I don't know of any other good reason to put humans at risk going to out toward Mars or in the distant part of the solar system except that. So it really gets back to our own long-range vision of ourselves as a species, and to the extent the United States plays a leading role, how much responsibility we want to take for the future.
To Milwaukee, Wisconsin now, Jack is on the line. Hello, Jack. Welcome.
Hi, welcome.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Yes?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, well, I just wanted to express sort of a frustration I have with NASA, because I've always been a space devotee, really. I studied a good part of my life hoping to be part of the space program, and as my friends became involved, and my brother became involved with NASA, and I saw some of the inside workings, it became clear to me that, you know, we're talking about NASA as a visionary organization, primarily motivated by science and exploration, but I don't think that explains the facts of what we see NASA do. I think NASA is primarily a political organization that is intent on expanding its budget and maintaining its sort of sovereignty in this arena at any expense.
Well, Jack, let's put that question to George Abbey. He's former director of the Johnson Space Center. George, I'm sure that's a charge you've heard before.
Yes, and I guess I would have to say I don't agree with that. I think at NASA, if you look at the achievements that have been made, the robotic activities and the human activities and the activities in the field of aeronautics, NASA has done a lot over these last 40 years. They've accomplished quite a bit and contributed a great deal. And we talk about the investment. This money that we talk about investing in these programs doesn't go into space. It gets spent right here in this country. And you see the results in our universities by the investments in education in the universities. You see it invested in technology and industry. So everything that we invested in the Apollo program when we took humans to the moon, we have gained immensely from, and we've been living off a lot of that technology for the last 40 years. So, you know, as you look at what you gain by what you invest, you gain not only the scientific knowledge and understanding that we've gained from our robotic and our human spaceflight activities, but you also gain in that technology, and you gain by the investment in our university community, because that's going to be important for the future.
Brendan's on the line now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Brendan.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'm very excited about space exploration, and I'm interested in the robotic missions, but for some reason I find the manned exploration much more exciting. And I think it's similar to when Europeans first started exploring the oceans. They didn't say, wow, you know, exploring just off the coast is great, let's not try to go any further. They kept going, and I think LEO is like those early efforts by the Europeans. And also, finally, I'm very excited about the private sector, like the Spaceship One and Bert Rutan, and I just wish I could see what happens in the next 100 years.
All right, Brendan, so do we all. Thanks for the call. Yes.
Can I respond to that? Yeah, I think the issue is where should or will private funds go and where should or will public funds go? And in terms of the private sector, over any length of time, it has to carry the prospect of a profit on investment. And it's not at all clear to me that anything out in deep space satisfies that requirement and is not likely to for some decades. And so I think it's going to be the domain of public money. That being said, we have to ask, is it being wisely spent, especially if it involves humans? And that gets us back to the benefits of using humans compared to the risk. And so unless they're exploring, unless they're trying to find places we could go or our descendants could go, then I'm not at all convinced it's worth doing.
Well, I want to ask all three of you, if you will, just very briefly reflect on where you expect the space program to be 10, 20, 30 years from now. Andy Chaikin, you want to start?
Well, I don't know that it's possible to predict that just because of all of the difficulties that we've been talking about, but I hope that 10 or 20 years from now we have the infrastructure that we need to routinely send both robots and humans beyond Earth orbit to the vicinity of the moon and out towards the other planets, and that we do it in such a way that we don't decimate space science. Space science needs to be preserved as we do these things. At the same time, I hope that we have more and more opportunities for these things to be done privately, and that space is accessible to everyday folks, because I think it's going to be a tremendously uplifting experience for anybody that does get that opportunity. So that's where I'm hopeful, but not at all sure.
And George Abbey, if I can ask for a very quick summary from you.
Well, I think I would agree completely with Andy. I think his vision is my vision as well. And I think that's the concern I have, is whether we're going to be able to go in that direction, recognizing the problems and difficulties that face us today. So I think that's the right way to go, and we should go in that direction. And I think as we look at robotic and human activities, I think we don't operate our laboratories here on Earth robotically. We have humans in those laboratories, and for that same reason, I think it's important to put the humans out to explore. And I think that's where we need to go, and hopefully we can overcome some of these obstacles that we're facing today.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. We thank all of you so much. George Abbey, Senior Fellow in Space Policy at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, former Director of the Johnson Space Center. Thanks, George.
Thank you.
Thank you to you also, Bruce Murray, who joined us from Pasadena, Professor Emeritus of Geology and Planetary Sciences at Caltech from 1976 to 82, Director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Thank you, Bruce.
It's been a pleasure.
And Andy Chaikin, who joined us from Arlington, Vermont, science journalist, space historian, author of a forthcoming book about the passion for Mars exploration. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Gail.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In just a moment, a preview of President Bush's address to the nation. This is On Point. With polls showing popular support for the war in Iraq continuing to drop, President Bush will address the nation tonight and urge Americans to steel their resolve. The president will speak in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, on the one-year anniversary of the formal transfer of sovereignty to Iraqis. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the president will try to focus Americans on the progress being made in Iraq and away from the daily reports of violence. At least 70 American soldiers have been killed in Iraq so far this month, more than 400 this year, and more than 1,740 in all so far. I'm joined now from Fort Bragg by Rusty Jacobs, reporter with North Carolina public radio station WUNC. Rusty, welcome.
Thanks, Gail.
It sounds as if you are right in the thick of things. What were you hearing from soldiers today at Fort Bragg, and what have you been hearing so far tonight?
Well, I've been hearing that the effort that you mentioned on the behalf of the Bush administration to turn the focus away from that daily grind and the daily reports of violence is a very tall task. It's not necessarily reaching the people, even in a military community like this. In the past couple of days, I've spoken with active duty soldiers, some of whom just arrived back from year-long deployments in Iraq, expressing pretty candidly their concerns that there's not a lot of direction, and that even the justification for being at war in Iraq is questionable. That's not to say there aren't people here who support the war. One veteran I spoke with, a 20-year veteran of Special Forces, a combat veteran, said he doesn't want to hear anything tonight about policy changes. He likes the policies the way they are. I will say this, that in a military community like this, invariably the people who live here and work here say that preface everything by saying we support the troops. They make a very clear distinction between opposing a policy, opposing a war, and supporting the troops.
Of course, but aside from the actual troops, what about the families? I mean, there must be some misgivings among families who are having to send their loved ones away.
Yeah, and but imagine how hard it would be to have a child or a spouse or a sibling at war and then speak out against it. That being said, that is in fact being done. There's a peace vigil going on as we speak. It's fairly small, about 50 people downtown in Fayetteville, which is home to Fort Bragg, who've been demonstrating off and on over the past couple of years. And it's people who represent a number of anti-war groups. There's a Quaker group. There is a group that was formed at the outset of the war, Military Families Against the War. So there are indeed military families. One of the gentlemen I spoke with at that gathering has two sons, both of whom have served in Iraq, and he cleared it with them. They don't begrudge his opposition to the war, and he carries around their pictures saying that real support for the troops is to bring them home.
And Rusty, what can you tell us about the president's current popularity in North Carolina and also about public support for the war in North Carolina?
Well, I can tell you that President Bush won big in North Carolina, just like he did back in 2000. It's a fairly safe place for him politically. That being said, the war and the policy is taking a hit. There was a poll reported on today in the Raleigh News and Observer newspaper that showed increasing numbers of North Carolinians questioning the cost of the war, questioning whether it was justified or worth the cost. So you've seen, numbers go up to 49% of respondents saying they do not think the war is worth the cost, and those saying yes, it's worth it, down to 42%. That's a big change because the previous poll by the News and Observer back in January of 2004, I think it was, had the people saying that it was worth it up at 58%. So statistically, they're practically even, and those are troubling numbers. And imagine again, that comes from a state that's one of the top military friendly states, and we're talking about third or fourth largest military presence in the country. In North Carolina, but you're seeing the kind of trends you've been seeing in the nationwide polls.
Well, and as to that, with the numbers and the trends, does the president need to be more than inspirational tonight? Do you think people are really looking for some specifics?
Well, again, I can only go by my random sampling, but my random sampling did turn up a lot of people, but even someone who was in support of the war saying, yeah, I've always thought the war was a good idea or invading Iraq is a good idea, but I would love some details, like to know how we're going to get out. I don't know that he's going to do any more, though, than kind of rouse the supporters he already has. I mean, he's picked a very comfortable place to be, a controlled environment like a military base, like Fort Bragg. He's not likely to meet a lot of, cold shoulders out there tonight. So he's probably going to get the response he'd like. If he went walking the streets outside the gates of the base, it might be a different story. He might get a more mixed reaction. It may just be that he needs to rally the troops, so to speak, that support him already.
Thanks so much, Rusty.
My pleasure.
Rusty Jacobs is a reporter with North Carolina Public Radio Station, WUNC. He spoke with me from Fort Bragg. President Bush will step to the podium at Fort Bragg just minutes from now. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.